The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Mark Weber Report. Mr. Weber is a historian, author, current affairs analyst, and director of the Institute for Historical Review. Visit the IHR at ihr.org. And now, Mark Weber.
Hello and welcome. Christian Zionists are fundamentalist and evangelical American Protestants who support Israel. This group and the phenomenon of Christian Zionism are important because Christian Zionists are the single most important bloc of non-Jewish American supporters of the Zionist state, of Israeli policies, and of the U.S. alliance with Israel. Christian Zionists are a key support group for the Republican Party. They support a hawkish, belligerent U.S. foreign policy. They bolster the so-called neoconservative policies of Republicans. During the presidential administration of George W. Bush, Christian Zionists supported President Bush's policies of war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Some Christian leaders have combined political conservatism with Christian Zionism. Among them are Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, two leading figures of what has been called the Christian right. Jerry Falwell has summed up the Christian Zionist view with this statement, quote, "To stand against Israel is to stand against God. We believe that history and scripture prove that God deals with nations in relation to how they deal with Israel," unquote. A boost to Christian Zionism has come in the form of a series of novels by Tim LaHaye and Jerry B. Jenkins, the so-called Left Behind series of novels, which present a view of Israel as playing a key role in the apocalyptic end times, which is supposed to be the era we're living in now. Christian Zionism is a factor in the current presidential campaign, probably the most prominent and vehement Republican candidate for the presidency, who is vehement in her support of Israel, is Michelle Bachmann. She emphasizes what she calls her love of Israel and claims that U.S. support for Israel is crucial, not only for Israel, but also for the United States. On the IHR website, we have posted on the homepage an essay entitled, What Christians Don't Know About Israel. This is a very well-written, succinct item written by an American writer named Grace Halsell. Although Grace Halsell died a few years ago, her essay is still very pertinent, very worthwhile, and I urge listeners to take a look at it. Grace Halsell was a distinguished journalist, war correspondent, author, and columnist, and she was the author of some 13 books. In this essay, she wrote, "American Jews sympathetic to Israel dominate key positions in all areas of our government where decisions are made regarding the Middle East. This being the case, is there any hope of ever changing U.S. policy? American presidents, as well as most members of Congress, support Israel, and they know why. U.S. Jews sympathetic to Israel donate lavishly to their campaign coffers. The answer to achieving an even-handed Middle East policy might lie elsewhere, among those who support Israel, but don't really know why. This group is the vast majority of Americans. They are well-meaning, fair-minded Christians who feel bonded to Israel and Zionism, often from atavistic feelings, in some cases dating from childhood. I am one of those. I grew up listening to stories of a mystical, allegorical, spiritual Israel. This was before a modern political entity with the same name appeared on our maps. I attended Sunday school and watched an instructor draw down window-type shades to show maps of the Holy Land. I imbibed stories of a good and chosen people who fought against their bad, unchosen enemies. In my early 20s, I began traveling the world, earning my living as a writer. I came to the subject of the Middle East rather late in my career. I was sadly lacking in knowledge regarding the area. About all I knew was what I had learned in Sunday school. And typical of many U.S. Christians, I somehow considered a modern state created in 1948 as a homeland for Jews persecuted under the Nazis as a replica of the spiritual, mystical Israel I heard about as a child. When, in 1979, I initially went to Jerusalem, I planned to write about the three great monotheistic religions and leave out politics. "Not write about politics," scoffed one Palestinian smoking a water pipe in the old walled city. "We eat politics morning, noon, and night." As I would learn, the politics is about land and the co-claimants to that land, the indigenous Palestinians who have lived there for 2,000 years, and the Jews who started moving in large numbers after the Second World War. By living among Israeli Jews, as well as Palestinian Christians and Muslims, I saw, heard, smelled, experienced the police state tactics Israelis use against Palestinians. My research led to a book entitled Journey to Jerusalem. My journey not only was enlightening to me as regards Israel, but also I came to a deeper and sadder understanding of my own country. I say sadder understanding because I began to see that in Middle East politics, we the people are not making the decisions, but rather that supporters of Israel are doing so. And typical of most Americans, I tended to think the U.S. media was free to print news impartially. In the late 1970s, when I first went to Jerusalem, I was unaware that editors could and would classify news depending on who was doing what to whom. On my initial visit to Israel-Palestine, I had interviewed dozens of young Palestinian men. About one in four related stories of torture. Israeli police had come in the night, dragged them from their beds, and placed hoods over their heads. Then, in jails, the Israelis had kept them in isolation, besieged them with loud, incessant noises, hung them upside down, and had sadistically mutilated their genitals. I had not read such stories in the U.S. media. Wasn't it news? Obviously, I naively thought, U.S. editors simply didn't know it was happening. On a trip to Washington, D.C., I hand-delivered a letter to Frank Mankiewicz, then head of the public radio station WETA. I explained I had taped interviews with Palestinians who had been brutally tortured, and I'd make them available to him. I got no reply. I made several phone calls. Eventually, I was put through to a public relations person, a Ms. Cohen, who said my letter had been lost. I wrote again. In time, I began to realize that what I hadn't known, had it been Jews who were strung up and tortured, it would be news. But interviews with tortured Arabs were lost at WETA. Grace Halsell goes on to relate how she spoke about her experiences and what she observed in speaking to audiences in the United States, especially church groups. She writes, "Speaking of these injustices, I invariably heard the same question. How come I didn't know this? Or someone might ask, but I haven't read about this in my newspaper." To these church audiences, I related my own learning experience, that of seeing hordes of U.S. correspondents covering a relatively tiny state. I pointed out that I had not seen so many reporters in world capitals such as Beijing, Moscow, London, Tokyo, Paris. Why, I asked, did a small state with a 1980 population of only 4 million warrant more reporters than China with a billion people? I also linked this query with my findings that the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and most of our nation's print media are owned and or controlled by Jews supportive of Israel. It was for this reason, I deduced, that they sent so many reporters to cover Israel, and to do so largely from the Israeli point of view. Grace Halsell goes on to say, increasingly, American Jews have fallen victim to Zionism, a nationalistic movement that passes for many as a religion. While the ethical instructions of all great religions, including the teachings of Moses, Muhammad, and Christ, stress that all human beings are equal, militant Zionists take the position that the killing of a non-Jew does not count. Over five decades now, Zionists have killed Palestinians with impunity. And in the 1996 shelling of a UN base in Qana, Lebanon, the Israelis killed more than 100 civilians sheltered there. As an Israeli journalist, Arya Shavat, explains of the massacre, quote, "We believe with absolute certitude that right now, with the White House in our hands, the Senate in our hands, and the New York Times in our hands, the lives of others do not count the same way as our own." Grace Halsell goes on, "In the teachings of Christ, there was a break from such Talmudic teachings. He sought to heal the wounded, to comfort the downtrodden. The danger, of course, for U.S. Christians is that, having made an icon of Israel, we fall into a trap of condoning whatever Israel does, even wanton murder, as orchestrated by God." While Israel and its dedicated U.S. Jewish supporters know they have the president and most of the Congress in their hands, they worry about grassroots America, the well-meaning Christians who care for justice. Thus far, most Christians were unaware of what I was. They didn't know about Israel. They were indoctrinated by U.S. supporters of Israel in their own country, and when they traveled to the land of Christ, most did so under Israeli sponsorship. That being the case, it was unlikely a Christian ever met a Palestinian or learned what caused the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This is gradually changing, however, and this change disturbs the Israelis. Well, that's the end of this portion, quoting from this essay by Grace Halsell. As I mentioned, it's a succinct, well-written piece that's available on the IHR website. It's also been reprinted in leaflet form by the IHR and is available for purchase from the IHR as a flyer. Few of those Israeli-loving Christians in the U.S., that is, those who say they love Israel, realize just what a small and odd minority they are among the world's Christians and how out of step they are with the views of Christians down through the centuries. In justifying their support of Israel, Christian Zionists repeatedly cite a portion of the book of Genesis, a portion that says, "Those who curse you, Israel, will be cursed, and those who bless you will be blessed." Well, this is from the book of Genesis, the Old Testament. But a central tenet of the Jewish faith, one that has been upheld for centuries and is still upheld by most Christians around the world, is that the Old Testament covenant between God and the Hebrews has been replaced by a new relationship, this one between God and all humanity. The pro-Christian Zionists, with their strange, unusual notion of Christianity, is one that is rooted more in the Old Testament than in the New Testament of Jesus and the Apostles. These pro-Israeli Christians in the United States are, in a sense, wannabe Jews. In fact, in many conversations over the years I've had with Christian Zionists, I've been struck that many of these Christian Zionists, many evangelical and fundamentalist Christians, seem actually to admire Israel precisely because they like its swaggering, supremacist and arrogant attitude and policies. Many of these Christian Zionists seem to want an America with something of that same outlook and attitude. In my conversations with pro-Israel American Christians, I've been struck with how astonishingly ignorant about history, about other cultures, and about the world outside the United States these people are. These fundamentalist Christians are often ignorant even about the views and traditions of Christians outside the United States. For example, American Christian Zionists and fundamentalist Christians seem to know nothing about the great Orthodox Christian heritage of Russia, Greece, and other countries. It's important to emphasize that the overwhelming majority of Christians around the world, including Anglicans, Lutherans, Roman Catholic, Orthodox, reject Christian Zionism. And even here in the United States, most Christian churches reject so-called Christian Zionism, some of them explicitly. Christian churches in the U.S. that have pointedly criticized Christian Zionism include the United Methodist Church, the Presbyterian Church USA, and the United Church of Christ. The Reformed Church in America has declared that the ideology of Christian Zionism and the extreme form of so-called dispensationalism that undergirds it is a distortion of the biblical message, and that it is an impediment to achieving a just resolution of the Israel-Palestine conflict. The Mennonite Church has published an article referencing what it calls the ongoing illegal seizure of additional Christian lands by Israeli militants, noting that in some churches under the influence of Christian Zionism, congregations quote, adopt, unquote, illegal Israeli settlements, sending funds to bolster the defense of these armed colonies. For pro-Israel American Christians, the existence of Palestinian Arab Christians is understandably an embarrassment. Christian Zionists would like to pretend that Palestinian Christians do not exist. They don't like being reminded that at least some of today's Palestinian Christians are descendants of the first followers of Jesus and the apostles nearly 2,000 years ago. There were Christians in Palestine long before there were Christians in England, in France, in Germany, in Sweden, or in the United States, certainly. One person who has spoken about this is Charles Carlson, who has been very active in enlightening American Christians about the realities of the Israel-Palestine conflict. He once gave an address at an IHR meeting, and during his talk, he spoke very movingly about his visit to a Baptist church in the Gaza Strip area, in the Gaza region, and he talked about the solidarity that Christians and Muslims have because they're equally oppressed by Israel. And he asked, and with some astonishment, he asked Palestinians at this church why it is that they don't hate America. Because as Palestinians know, as everyone in the Middle East knows, as in fact as people around the world know, Israel's policies of occupation, war, dispossession, and oppression are made possible only with continued and steadfast support from the United States government, from the U.S. In fact, pro-Israel Christians in this country should be ashamed of their betrayal of fellow Christians who live under Israeli occupation in the Gaza region and elsewhere in the Middle East. In one article that Charles Carlson has written, he had this to say: Christian Zionism is a growing enigma to traditional Christians and to non-Christians alike, and it may come as a surprise that most of those inside its churches are very sure of what they believe, but not at all sure why they believe it. In this author's conclusion, based on personal observations at some 60 churches, where Project Straight Gate has confronted and interviewed congregation and staff, that none of the dispensationalist or Judeo-Christians inside can open a New Testament and support what they believe from its pages. Most will not try. The problem for Christ followers in Judeo-Christian churches is that their belief system varies depending on who is in the room and what the subject is. If the subject is personal salvation for those who are present, Jesus Christ is the King, and His word is law. However, many passages are avoided, but whenever the subject is the state of Israel, or any news topic having to do with Zionism or Jews in general, Jesus is left out in the street. There can be little or no room left for him because political Zionists, secular American Jews, or Israelis have zero tolerance for Jesus. Israel and Jesus mix like oil and water. For the most part, the words of Christ are unwelcome in Zionist circles, which may explain why his words are increasingly ignored and distorted by celebrity Judeo-Christians aspiring to a seat among the political Zionists. Several years ago, the Palestinian Christian churches issued a joint statement on Christian Zionism. It was signed by the leaders of the Latin Patriarchate of Jerusalem, that is, Catholic Palestinians, the Syrian Orthodox Patriarchate, that is, Orthodox Palestinian Christians, the Episcopal Church in Jerusalem in the Middle East, and the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jordan and the Holy Land, that is, Protestant Arab Palestinian Christians. This joint statement, which is entitled The Jerusalem Declaration on Christian Zionism, rejects Christian Zionism as, and I'm quoting, a false teaching that corrupts the biblical message of love, justice, and reconciliation. It condemns Christian Zionism for substituting a political military program in place of the teachings of Jesus Christ. In this statement, Palestinian Christians also declared, "The Christian Zionist program provides a worldview where the gospel is identified with the ideology of empire, colonialism, and militarism. In its extreme form, it places an emphasis on apocalyptic events leading to the end of history rather than living Christ's love and justice today." The Jerusalem Declaration condemns current Christian Zionist support for the territorial expansion of Israel. It supports nonviolent resistance as, quote, the most effective means to end the illegal occupation in order to attain a just and lasting peace. Palestinian Christian leaders have also been vocal in supporting the Kairos Palestine document, which calls for a boycott around the world against Israel until it stops its discriminatory policies in the Palestinian territories. The relationship between Christian Zionists and American Jews is an entirely one-sided, one-way affair. While Christian Zionists affirm their support for Israel and the interests of the organized Jewish community, American and Israeli Jews do not return the favor. American Jews do not support a single one of the issues of concern to evangelical Christians, except, of course, support for Israel and for Jewish Zionist interests. Well, it's certainly true that pro-Israeli Christians number in the millions and have a track record of helping to elect politicians, most of them Republican. But pro-Israel Christians flatter themselves about the extent of their power and influence. On every social and political issue other than Israel, Christian Zionists have a miserable track record of failure and lack of any real influence or impact. In fact, Christian Zionists are political weaklings on every issue except Israel. They are like mice riding on the backs of elephants who flatter themselves that they are powerful. Of course, Zionist Jews are happy to accept the support of Christian Zionists for Jewish Zionist goals and interests. The government of Israel has given official encouragement to Christian Zionism, allowing the establishment in Jerusalem of something called the International Christian Embassy. The main function of this center is to enlist worldwide Christian support for Israel. It's also raised funds to help finance Jewish immigration to Israel and has assisted Zionist groups in establishing Jewish settlements in the West Bank, that is, illegal settlements in occupied Palestinian lands. Well, we'll take a break now and return in a few moments with the second half of this broadcast.
Stay tuned for more of the Mark Weber Report. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
All right. Well, with an increased number of economists saying the U.S. is headed back into recession, consumer confidence plunging to the lowest level in more than 2 years, and new jobs numbers out Friday expected to disappoint, the president is out talking jobs and investment. He's pushing to extend some bills set to expire next month. Here's what he's saying about them.
That's what we're going to need to do in the short term. Keep people on the job, keep vital projects moving forward. Fund projects that are already underway in a smarter way. Of course, if we're honest, we also know that when it comes to our nation's infrastructure, our roads, our railways, mass transit, airports, we shouldn't just be playing patch-up or catch-up. We should be leading the world.
All right, well, you can give a speech, but in reality, Obama and Congress have failed to deliver so far with 2 years of around 9% unemployment. Likely a bigger deal next month. What we could see in September, what we're hearing more and more about, is that the Fed may be the one to act again with another round of quantitative easing. Now, the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, an official there, is saying the Fed should consider it. On Wall Street, J.P. Morgan is calling for it, saying they think it's coming in September. Goldman Sachs thinks it's coming, too. Federal Reserve minutes also show that they came this close in August. But just who would this help? Now, we know that quantitative easing has helped Wall Street because it's boosted the equity market and created a demand for treasuries already on their books. And it's also helped the federal government because it's allowed them to borrow at an extremely low price because it pushes down the yields on treasuries. But what would this do for everyone else, for millions of jobless Americans afraid or too broke to spend, underwater on their mortgages, or for small businesses, which Ben Bernanke says still can't get loans? Well, here to help us answer that is Lou Rockwell. He is chairman of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Thank you so much for being here. It's nice to see you again. Mr. Rockwell,
great to be with you.
Absolutely. You know, we know that quantitative easing in the past has helped Wall Street and certainly the federal government in Washington. But how has it helped everyone else, just average folks who are broke and jobless?
Well, it might as well. It takes a hammer and hits them in the head is what it does. We're still in a recession. There's not been a recovery. One of the reasons is because what the government is doing, what the Federal Reserve is doing, to hold down interest rates so low, as you say, to benefit the federal government, to benefit places like Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan. And just like Europe is being raked over the coals to the benefit of the big banks, so are Americans. So the average Joe, the average Janet is being harmed to the benefit of the power elite. So what is quantitative easing? It's money printing. And they print up this money, and it has a horrendous effect on the economy. And we're already starting.
Let's return to the Mark Weber Report, brought to you by VOR.
Welcome back. When we went on break, I was talking about Christian Zionism and the relationship between Christian Zionists in the United States and Zionist Jews, both in the United States and Israel, on the other hand. Of course, Zionist Jews, I said, are happy to accept the support of Christian Zionists for Jewish Zionist goals and interests. But Zionist Jews completely understandably, regard these Christian Zionists with contempt, merely as temporarily useful idiots. The United States is the only country where there is a large or significant number of Christians who ardently support Israel. That's not because Christian Zionists understand their religion better than Christians anywhere else in the world. In large measure, this strange phenomenon of pro-Israel Christianity in the United States is a reflection of the Jewish Zionist grip on American cultural, political, and educational life. The reality is that in today's America, those who bend to Jewish Zionist power are rewarded, and those who oppose this power or stand up to it are silenced or marginalized. Christian Zionists overwhelmingly regard themselves as conservatives and supporters of American traditional policies in foreign and domestic affairs. But in their ardent support for Israel, Christian Zionists betray authentic conservative principles and traditions. This is an important point because Christian Zionists are confused about their own traditions, the traditions even here in the United States. They reject the traditional principle of U.S. foreign policy that was laid out by George Washington and other founders in the early years of the United States, and for which for many years was a cornerstone of U.S. relations with the rest of the world. This traditional U.S. foreign policy is one of staying out of foreign conflicts, of avoiding what Washington called entangling alliances with foreign countries, and a rejection of what Washington called a passionate attachment to foreign states. Christian Zionists not only embrace a passionate attachment to Israel, they insist that U.S. support Israeli policies even when they violate U.S. law, violate U.S. interests, and the interests of world peace. With their strange interpretation of the Bible, one that is not shared by the vast majority of Christians around the world, Christian Zionists harm authentic American interests. In 1948, President Truman gave U.S. diplomatic recognition to the new Israeli entity immediately following its proclamation in May of that year. I've often called this the original sin of U.S. foreign policy, because American presidents since then, and American policy since then, has been one of strong, even fervent support for Israel, regardless of the consequences. In 1948, when President Truman recognized Israel, he did so rejecting the advice of nearly every American official who was responsible for U.S. foreign policy. Secretary of State George C. Marshall angrily told Truman that recognizing Israel would be putting partisan political interests above America's national interest. Those who were responsible for American foreign policy knew at the time in 1948, and objective observers of U.S. foreign policy in the years since then understand that U.S. and Israeli interests are not identical, that they often conflict, and that when the United States supports Israel with blank check support in the way that it has, it's putting partisan political interests ahead of the American national interest, and of course ahead of what's good for the interests of humanity and world peace. In 1948, the head of the U.S. State Department's Bureau for Middle Eastern Affairs, Loy Henderson, warned President Truman that U.S. backing for the new Zionist regime would be, and here I'm quoting, contrary to the interests of the United States and will eventually involve us in international difficulties, of so grave a character that the reaction throughout the world, as well in this country, will be very strong. Henderson advised that advised the president that Zionists, and here he says, I'm quoting, ignored such principles as self-determination and majority rule, and instead embraced the principle of a theocratic racial state. Henderson also warned that the establishment of a U.S.-backed Zionist entity would guarantee that the Palestine problem would be permanent and still more complicated in the future. Well, what Secretary of State Marshall, Secretary of Defense Forrestal, Loy Henderson, and many others who were responsible for U.S. affairs in 1948 saw, and that other Americans have seen since then, those fears proved to be well-grounded and prophetic, because the United States has paid a high, high price, not only in terms of billions and billions of dollars, but also in terms of lost American lives in its one-sided blank check support for Israel. Contrary to the claims made by Christian Zionists and by such Christian Zionist politicians as Michelle Bachmann, U.S. support for Israel has never been in America's authentic interest. Christian Zionists who support Israel, by doing so, show that they have betrayed the very conservative principles they claim to uphold. This is illustrated, for example, in the view of Christian Zionists about the settlements issue, the issue of Israeli settlements in occupied Palestinian territory. Just recently, President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton urged Israel to halt or stop the expansion of the settlements program in the West Bank. And Obama was criticized vehemently for this by Christian Zionist leaders and by Republicans. But this is astonishing, considering that opposition to these settlements is a position that even conservative American presidents have taken. This has been consistent since 1967, when Israel seized the West Bank and the Gaza Territory. In 1967, the United Nations Security Council passed Security Council Resolution 242, calling for immediate Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank area. Israel not only defied this resolution, which the United States government supposedly supports, but has compounded the violation by continuing to expand these settlements. But even the hero of many conservatives, President Ronald Reagan, opposed these settlements. And yet these same conservatives who say they admire President Reagan condemn Barack Obama and others who express the same view that Ronald Reagan had in 1980-82. This lack of a consistent policy based upon what is good for America or humanity just points up once again the intellectual bankruptcy of the Christian Zionist view of the Middle East and of the world. In the last few weeks, one of the most remarkable and non-reported or barely reported news items has been the visit to Israel during August of 81 members of the United States Congress. This has been very underreported in the United States media. One person who has written well about this is Allison Weir, who has been very active, perhaps one of the most, in my view, one of the most courageous and effective speakers for a sane and just U.S. Middle East policy. She is now president of the Council for the National Interest, an organization that works for an even-handed and just resolution of the Israel-Palestinian conflict and an authentically pro-American foreign policy in the Middle East. Allison Weir wrote about this amazing phenomenon in a recent piece. She wrote, "You might think that 20% of the American Congress going on all-expenses-paid week-long junkets to a foreign country, paid for by a lobby for that country, would be newsworthy, especially when the top congressional leaders of both parties are leading the trips. You would be wrong. 81 congressional representatives from all over the country, led by Democratic Whip Steny Hoyer and House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, are traveling to Israel this month. Most are freshman congressmen, and the group includes half of all the freshman Republicans voted into office in 2010. The week-long trips are being paid for by the American Israel Education Foundation, which was created in 1990 as a supporting organization of AIPAC, that is the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, the foremost pro-Israel lobbying organization in Washington. And both organizations are located in the same building. AIEF is only one of numerous organizations pushing pro-Israel policies, has an annual budget of over $25 million with an even larger endowment. As Allison Weir goes on to note, this is an extraordinary situation. No other lobby on behalf of a foreign country comes anywhere near controlling such wealth or taking so many of America's elected representatives on a propaganda trip to its favorite country. She goes on to note that not everyone going on these trips is enthusiastic. The wife of one congressman who made a similar trip some years ago said that she and her husband had never been exposed to such pressures in all their lives. She said that at one point on her trip, her husband, a normally extremely tough man, was curled up in a fetal position. A staff member of one representative participating in this month's junkets said that the representative had no choice. If the congressional rep didn't go on the trip, the rep would be targeted by AIPAC. Large quantities of money, including massive out-of-state money, would be raised for the opponent in the next election, and quite likely the representative would be defeated. The staffer said that the Israel lobby is far too powerful to ignore, and that American voters have no knowledge of what's going on. It's no surprise that voters are unaware that their representatives are being propagandized and pressured by a foreign lobby, because their news media, the American news media, almost never tells them. The Associated Press, America's number one news service, has decided not to report on a lobbying group taking 81 representatives to a foreign country in order to influence their votes. Even though the trip has been reported by the news media in Britain, Iran, India, Israel, Lebanon, and in Russia, elsewhere, the Associated Press has decided not to give the story a pass. By the same token, the New York Times, USA Today, Fox News, CNN, ABC have likewise failed to inform Americans about the trips. Surveys find that an extraordinarily strong majority of Americans, typically between two-thirds and three-quarters, do not wish the United States to take sides on the Israel-Palestine issue. Such a widespread desire for neutrality is particularly noteworthy given that U.S. news sources across the political spectrum are constantly, consistently highly Israel-centered in their reporting. It is quite likely that such voters would be unhappy to learn that a foreign lobby has such power over their elected representatives, leading them to give the favored nation, one of the smallest and wealthiest countries on the planet, over $8 million a day of American tax money at a time when the United States is in the middle of a financial crisis. Another person who has written about this unreported story is Stephen Walt, a professor of international affairs at Harvard University. In a piece entitled "The Greatest Elected Body That Money Can Buy," Walt wrote, "Just when you think your contempt for Congress could not get any higher, Our elected representatives managed to do something to ratchet it up another notch. They are off on junkets to Israel, paid for by the American Israel Education Foundation, an AIPAC spinoff that has been funding such trips for years. That's right. During the August recess, nearly a fifth of the U.S. Congress is visiting a single country whose entire population is less than that of New York City. Why do congressmen do this, especially at a moment when it is obvious that they ought to be worrying about conditions here at home? Mostly because such junkets burnish a legislature's pro-Israel record. Well, as mentioned earlier, things are changing. There is far greater awareness of this level of corruption and pressure, corruption by our elected officials and pressure by the pro-Israel lobby here in the United States. There's many reasons for this. One of them is that as America faces greater internal, financial, and economic problems, the American public is far more willing to reconsider and reassess policies that it once took for granted. Another is that through the Internet, the public is far more aware of alternative points of view and has greater access to information than was the case in the past. 40 years ago, information for the vast majority of Americans came through a very, very few channels, through the three major television networks, through the wire services, the New York Times, the Washington Post. But today, people who want to inform themselves about issues are able to access readily information from newspapers and websites in foreign countries, from news services in foreign countries, and to learn about things that was not possible or very difficult before the Internet age. One expression of a increase in awareness and the willingness of more and more Americans to do something about it is in San Francisco, where advertisements and posters calling for an end to U.S. aid to Israel are now displayed on cable cars in San Francisco. A new series of ads calling for an end to U.S. military aid to Israel now greets commuters, tourists, students, and shoppers traveling on the San Francisco Bay Area's public transit system. These ads are part of a growing national campaign, and they've started with in San Francisco, but they'll be expanding to other areas as well. Overall, the trend is increasingly one of greater awareness of what Israel is doing and an awareness that U.S. Policy of support for Israel is not only wrong and unjust, but also harmful to the interests of America and the world. Another interesting item that came up just recently with regard to Israel was the leaking of an astonishing cable dispatch, a report from the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv from May 2009. This dispatch is titled "Israel, a Promised Land for Organized Crime," unquote, and has been made public by, among other people, Ali Abu Nima, who is a very skilled journalist and writer, and this item will be posted soon on the IHR website and distributed by the IHR as well. As this report makes clear, known Israeli organized crime bosses are able to travel freely to the United States, unlike counterparts from Italy, China, and Central America, because the State Department has failed to apply U.S. law to them. It appears that at least one prominent Israeli crime family member was able to reach the United States with a specific intent to commit murder as a result of this exemption. This revelation comes in this May 2009 dispatch from the U.S. Embassy, which was released by WikiLeaks on August 26th. The dispatch also details the growing alarm of American officials, and I'm quoting, "Organized crime in Israel now has global reach with direct impact inside the United States." Israel, according to the report, is a world center of money laundering, drug trafficking, and trafficking in women for prostitution, and Israeli crime families operate international criminal syndicates involved in gambling, credit card, and technology fraud spanning the globe. Well, these are just a few of the items that appear. It seems like increasingly with each passing month, each passing week, that underscores, details, reaffirms the high price that Americans pay for the U.S. Support for Israel, a price that includes not only the direct billions and billions of dollars that are channeled to Israel from American taxpayers, but in all sorts of secondary ways hurts the interests of America and the world and the cause of world peace. We'll see this issue come up increasingly in the months ahead, but you can be assured, of course, that the political leaders of both the Democratic and Republican Party, who are concerned first and foremost with getting elected, will do nothing to highlight these things. And that's why the job of highlighting these important issues is up to Americans who are not beholden to powerful interest groups, including the Israel lobby, of course. Independent people who try to put the interests of the world and of America ahead of personal gain. And that's one of the reasons why the work of the IHR and other organizations that are trying to educate the public about these things is very important. In that regard, I urge those who are listening to check out the IHR website. There's a tremendous amount of material, not only dealing with the distortion of the truth and the reality about the Israel-Palestine conflict, but about the history of the Middle East in general, but beyond that, about 20th century history overall. Because the distortion of U.S. foreign policy and what Americans hear about the Middle East isn't confined to just that. It extends across the board on any aspect of history or current affairs that touch on Jewish Zionist interests. And this distortion of history, of course, includes a systematic and massive distortion of the history of the Second World War and other aspects of 20th century history. And in this broadcast and in other podcasts, as well as in the items that are posted continually on the IHR website, we try to enlighten the public. We understand and realize, of course, that it's not possible to compete with the major Hollywood studios or the major television networks, and therefore it's not possible to reach to the vast mass of people. But it is possible, and our duty, in fact, to try to reach to that small minority of people in any society who have both the intelligence and to understand about these issues and the soul and the character to care about them. That is, to care about the world we live in and the world that our children and grandchildren will inherit. Thank you for being with us for this broadcast, and I hope you'll join us for the next broadcast.
Thanks for listening. The Mark Weber Show returns Wednesday, 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time, only on VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.